One moment, Paul was alone, inspecting what might have been tracks. He wheeled at the sound and fired. He stood beside his machine. There was no need for cover. They were armed only with stone axes. His stomach churned. They had worn human skins for clothing, some of them with the facial hair or the hair from the head still intact. One wearing on the center of his chest what appeared to be a skinned human face, eyelids and lips still evident. The magazine in the Schmeisser he judged as more than half empty. Too startled to count his shots, something he had taught himself to do, something he had made second nature. But the sight of them, he shivered, stabbing the partially spent magazine into his trouser belt, taking a fresh 32-round stick for the Schmeisser and ramming it up the well. Paul shifted the Schmeisser to his left hand for an instant, drawing the battered Browning high power from the ballistic nylon tanker-style shoulder rig in which he carried it. The pistol in his belt, butt pointing left for access with his left hand, he took the subgun into his right fist again, steadying it with his left, waiting. Both 9mm ready, he was ready. And the cannibals were coming now, raising from their positions behind the rocks. The cannibals didn't hide, didn't run, didn't fall back. His fists locked to his weapon, he watched it, almost as if it were slow motion. The cannibals, their stone axes raised, running to meet him. He shifted the muzzle of the Schmeisser left. Stone axes were launching toward him as the men who had wielded them fell. But there were more of the cannibals coming, like a human wave. More of them were still coming, and the Schmeisser was empty. Paul Rubinstein let the subgun fall to his side on its sling, no time to reload it, finding the butt of the high power with his left hand, drawing it from his belt. The chamber was already loaded, and he thrust the pistol outward. Some of the cannibals he had already shot with the subgun, now with the high power, were rising again, moving toward him, as if they were not human, as if they were unkillable. His right hand found the Gerber MK2 fighting knife John had given him. Rubinstein drew the knife, holding it ready in his right fist like a short sword.
Hold on!
Natalia!
His right hand punched the Gerber to the hilt into the chest of a cannibal, through the dried skin from a dead woman the man wore. The high power crashed down against the man's forehead. The bite was suddenly a blur of motion and color, impacting at the knot of the cannibal surrounding him. Rubinstein hacked into the human wall closing in on him with the blade of the Gerber. The bodies were peeling back from him. Natalia was suddenly there, her balisong steel catching the sunlight. It flashed across faces and chests and hands and arms. She was beside him now, and suddenly they were back to back with only their knives.
John should be getting here.
A blood-covered cannibal came at Rubinstein with a stone axe upraised. No way to block it, he realized. He started to thrust the Gerber forward.
John.
Rubinstein sidestepped the falling bodies, stabbing the Gerber into the chest of the nearest attacker. Natalia spun beside him, hacking with her balisong against flesh. Suddenly they spotted Rourke shouldering through the mob, a knife in one hand, the python in the other.
We're winning!
Rubinstein's right arm ached as he worked the knife, cutting, hacking, killing. Paul Rubinstein eventually lowered his knife when there was no one left to fight. He would have fallen to his knees to rest, but there was no spot near him that wasn't littered with bodies or body parts. He closed his eyes.
Only the most strong among them would have survived, the very toughest. They'll try this again. We better get out of here after we check the skins the dead ones are wearing to make sure that one of them isn't Michael's.
Rubinstein shivered at the thought, but he opened his eyes so he could look for some fragment that would look like John's face, which was Michael's face, and he prayed that it would not be found. There had been no one alive to interrogate, Natalia reflected, realizing at once that the thought was horribly cold-blooded. But she had interrogated prisoners before, and she hoped she would never do it again. As she hugged her face against Rourke's back, the leather of his battered brown bomber jacket rough against her cheek, but good feeling to her, she wondered almost absently what she would have been like had she never joined the KGB as a young girl fresh from a polytechnic and fresh from studies of classical ballet. She had met Karamazov at the Chicago School in the Soviet Union. It was called the Chicago School, she had always been told, because the type of English taught there, practiced there, used unflinchingly there, was Middle Western urban English, the most accent-free. She had learned the advanced techniques of her then new craft there. And she had met Vladimir Karamazov there, the experienced field agent, the senior officer, the hero who daily had braved the hateful Americans in his fight to preserve the people of the Soviet Union. After marrying him, she had learned that he was a lie, and that so much of what she had been taught in school, so much of what she had been taught in the various levels of her KGB training, had been a lie. And John Rourke, the man whose body she hugged herself to as the Harley vibrated beneath them, speeding across the bumpy and rocky trails through the mountains, John, at her uncle's urging, had killed Vladimir after Vladimir had nearly killed her in a fit of rage, violated her humanity to the point where she had fought him in order to survive. And she had fallen in love with John Rourke. And now his wife seemed to despise him, or at least his actions, and those actions had been for her, she realized. He could say he had planned for the survival of the race, that six adults, three mating pairs, would be far greater guarantee of survival than only one. He could explain the logic. When he and Sarah someday died, the children would have been perhaps faced with incest or the extinction of the human race. And he would not have two wives. It was not his way. And Paul, Rourke had wanted to provide for Paul's happiness as well. Rourke had allowed his children to age to adulthood. And now, with only the most fragmentary clue, they searched for Rourke's son, for Michael. John had theorized that Michael, having encountered the cannibals, would have pursued them rather than the mysterious light he had seen in the sky. And so they had left the due northwesterly course they had followed ever since leaving the retreat, backtracking the cannibals' movements by their hideous trails of cook fires and human bones. That they ate their own weakened or sick was obvious. But where had they come from? They could not have survived on the surface after the sky had taken flame. He shuddered, less from the wind of the slipstream than from the fear they would find out. They had found tracks of Michael's bike, then lost them again, doubling back. Dismounted, they stood now just inside the tree line. Rubenstein pulled away the withered brush.
It's the bike you took from the brigands after they attacked the airplane, John.
Rourke looked at the younger man, then back to the blue Harley-Davidson lowrider.
Check her to see if she'll run. That gives us a bike for each of us until we find him.
Why would he have gone on foot?
Rourke looked at her, really seeing her for the first time in days. The surreal blueness of her eyes, the near blackness of her hair, the thing intangible inside her that made it so obvious to him that she loved him.
Michael would have been getting close to something. Maybe a concentration of the cannibals that he'd followed. The engine noise would have frightened them off, and apparently he wanted to observe them. So he left the bike. No pack, no other gear. Either he got in trouble and couldn't get back for it, or he's still following them close.
Then what should we do, John? If he's that close to them, maybe. What about our bikes?
Rourke glanced to Rubenstein for a moment, then back to Natalia.
They'd have several days' lead on us, most likely. If we start getting close to something, we'll play it by ear. But on foot, we'd be forced to travel too slowly. We can cover in an hour more territory than he could have covered in a day. We could find it by morning, maybe.
And Rourke looked skyward, the sun low, yellow-orange on the horizon.
We can go on in the dark for a time, at least.
Rourke only nodded. His eyes were searching the ground, and he moved now back from the bike and toward the partial clearing beyond the trees. It was guesswork only, he realized. No footprints would be visible on the hard ground. And the snow that had come and gone so quickly would have helped further to eradicate them. He wondered absently if it would snow for Christmas, and if he'd be home for it. He then wondered if he really had a home. He looked up from his search of the ground for a footprint he knew would not be there, feeling Natalia's hand at his shoulder. He saw in her eyes what he had thought he no longer had. The lights had been off when Michael had awakened, the room as dark as a starless and moonless night, but he had felt her beside him. In the darkness, Madison had cried that soon they would each, in turn, be one who goes. He had tried to explain death to her as he understood it, and he had held her as she cried again that if she carried his baby inside her, that it too would die. Michael had not known what to say to her. He looked at his Rolex. It had been hours before he had felt he could move sufficiently well, but he had unbuttoned the front of the dress she wore. She had told him it was gray and a worker's uniform, hours before he had touched his hands to her flesh, his right hand paining him, but the softness of her body making the pain less something of which he was aware. He had slipped between her legs to do again what they had done the night before. Her body had moved with him, beneath him, surrounding him. But what they had felt together, and that, he knew inside himself, was what had mattered. What few memories he had of his father's relationship with his mother made this seem somehow different. He was his father's son, he knew, but in the darkness there, holding Madison's burning warmth close against him, he realized he was not his father. Perhaps he carried in him some of his mother as well, the emotions which he remembered, tears, smiles, gentle songs in the night. Michael Rourke smiled. He had discovered himself. He wondered if, like himself, most people discovered themselves too late. There was still the knife, still the little knife in his sock. He could pick the knife up from inside his emptied boot where it was now and use it when they came for them at dawn. He assumed it would be dawn. No desire to ask Madison to make her remember. He could kill some of them with the knife, with the martial arts skills his father had taught him. Kill some of them, and before they got him, to kill Madison, to spare her the torment of being skinned alive by the cannibals. Michael held her more closely. One thing his father had taught him well, never give up. And very suddenly, as he now came to understand himself, he felt that he understood his father's torment regarding the woman Natalia. If there were anything to forgive his father, he forgave it. Life was to be lived. Michael touched his lips to Madison's forehead, felt her stir against him, felt her hand searching for his face, her lips finding his. It was to be lived as long as it could be. Michael had decided to wait. They were not bound, merely blindfolded. There had been no ropes in evidence, no manacles, only the prods and the admonition not to attempt an escape. He could feel the shifting in temperatures as they moved. The place was hermetically sealed. It was how it had survived the firestorm. But the price for survival had been too high. A second door opened, and he was urged through with the prods, but they were not activated. There were six of them, six men. He could kill six men, then perhaps escape with Madison into the hills beyond the place. He could fight off the cannibals again.
Wait here.
Madison had told him before the business-suited men had come for them that there were shackles built into the wall where she had been left for the one she called them. He had seen them when entering. The shackles required no key, but needed to be opened with two hands, and the shackles were so placed as to keep their victim's arms spread wide against the wall. He could be near the mouth of the cave now. He could feel the coolness of the air on his flesh.
Come with me. Do not try to resist.
As his right hand moved toward the voice in the darkness, his left moved toward the blindfold covering his eyes. The right hand found flesh, twisted and ripped. The man raised the cattle prod in his defense. Wheeling, he back-kicked, finding the man's groin. As that body stumbled back and away from him, Michael's right hand reached out to grab away the cattle prod. The other five of them came for him. Madison had pulled the blindfold from her eyes.
Look out, Michael!
Michael sidestepped right, ducking and wheeling. There had been a seventh man. He should have realized. The cattle prod hammered down toward him. Michael used the wooden prod like a billy club, holding it with both hands, blocking the blow, then ramming it into the abdomen of the seventh man. Letting go with his left hand, he swept the prod in a wide arc across the nose of the nearest of the five men coming for him. Another prod sliced the air toward him, his right arm going up, blocking the prod with his own. His body half-wheeled left. His right foot snapped up and out into the abdomen of his opponent. Then his right arm hammered the prod across the man's face. Three remained, two of them starting for him, their prods held like sabers, the ends of the tips glowing hot orange with the electrical pain they could cause. Michael started toward them, hacking the air before their faces with the prod. One of them fell back, and Michael wheeled to the second. Michael wheeled half right and landed a double taekwondo kick to the chest. The second man, he was driving fast, the prod in both hands to block a blow from the hand or arm. Michael drew his feet together, jumping upward, kicking hard. The man fell backward as Michael dropped. His knees took the fall, the prod still out in his own right hand, aimed toward the face of the man. The man edged back across the floor as Michael thrust the prod forward, sweeping it from left to right. The man's head bobbed back, and Michael kicked out. The man dodged, as Michael had known he would. Holding the prod in both hands now, Michael rammed it outward in a straight line for the man's Adam's apple. There was the smell of burning flesh, but the edge of the prod impacted skin. The man caved in, falling back. The last of the men were going back through the airlock to lock Michael and Madison out to be consumed by them. The cannibals were at the mouth of the cave. Michael looked back once.
Madison, run through the door! Hurry!
Michael's right hand found the coat of the last escaping guard, jerking back the man, who tried to lunge with his cattle prod. Michael's left hand snapped forward, the heel aimed for the base of the chin, but the man ducked. Michael's hand hit the man's nose, breaking it, driving bone splinters up into the brain. Michael threw his weight against the door, but it closed. Michael turned toward the mouth of the cave to see dozens of the cannibals, their stone axes held high to strike. Madison stood to his left. Michael reached down to the cattle prod, holding it now in his right fist. With his left hand, he found the knife hidden on his left leg.
Stay behind me. I won't let them get you.
Trapped, the airlock door closed. The cannibals filling the mouth of the cave in greater numbers by the minute, Michael stood his ground.
Michael!
Just stay behind me, Madison. Right behind me.
He could see the lust for blood in the eyes of the cannibals as they approached. The panel of rock had slid back into position. It was as if the door into the place had never existed. He felt Madison's hands behind him, touching gently at his neck where his shirt stopped.
Michael, kill me.
It was the first time she had used the word.
Make me die.
He looked at her. No longer did she think in terms of goes.
I love you. If it comes to that, don't worry. I won't let them have you.
A solitary tear left the corner of her right eye and started to journey down her cheek. Then her eyes filled with them. Michael looked away toward the cannibals, the ones she called them. He realized they were the spawn of the rigid population control inside the place. One of them could have been Madison's father or her brother. He had seen no cannibal women, which meant there was somewhere a village with women, children who would grow to become this. There were some prices too high to pay for survival. The cannibals had paid such a price, and the families in the place had, too. Inhumanity had spawned inhumanity. One of the larger cannibals stepped forward, clad in the skin of his past victims. His eyes were red, and suddenly he lunged for Michael, holding his axe high over his head. Michael ducked the axe and jabbed the prod into the cannibal's side. As the body shook with the current and fell to the ground, the axe dropped. Grabbing it up quickly, Michael swung it hard into the cannibal's chest. He stepped back, leaving the body on the ground. A dozen of the cannibals suddenly ran toward the body. They dismembered the body, hacking it to pieces.
Michael!
One of them had the man's left leg over his shoulder, the hip joint dripping blood. Another group of cannibals then spotted one of the dead cattle prod armed guards and smothered his body as well. One of the cannibals bit into the raw flesh of a dismembered human thigh. Michael edged back with Madison. The other bodies were, one after another, set upon, torn, some of the cannibals lapping blood from their victims. One of the cannibals, a human ear being chewed half outside the right corner of his mouth, turned from his meal, staring. He gestured toward Michael. Another of the cannibals turned, blood dripping from both corners of his mouth. More of the cannibals turned toward them now, some of their axes catching in the sunlight as it grew to fill the cave, red glistening from them, the wetness of human blood. A cannibal started for him, slowly, his axe raised. As the cannibal lunged, Michael stabbed the cattle prod forward, the hot end impacting the cannibal's right eye. He fell back, grabbing his face, then crawling off. Michael brandished the prod, ready, waiting for what he knew was inevitable. Three cannibals now came toward him. Their axes were raised high.
Stop, or we will kill you all!
She means it. So do I.
The cannibals turned, one by one, slowly. Parting slightly, creating a human corridor from the mouth of the cave to the rear, where Michael stood ready to defend Madison. Although backlit by the sunlight behind him, the figure at the center of the mouth of the cave, with a gleaming Detonix 45 automatic in each fist, was instantly recognizable to Michael.
If you understand English, let those two people pass. Let them come to us.
There was no answer from the two waves of the cannibals which flanked Michael and Madison.
Michael, come ahead. Keep the girl beside you, not behind you. Don't do anything sudden.
All right, Dad.
They don't speak English. I'm pretty sure of that by now. but they're smart enough to know what's going on here. When you're close enough, I'll toss you a gun, loaded and ready to go. They don't want to let you out of here.
He is your father. You are in his image.
Stay beside me. Now, and after we get out of here alive.
Always.
He leaned toward her and put his arm around her shoulders. Then he looked back toward the mouth of the cave. The black jumpsuited woman holding the M16 was Natalia Anastasia Temerovna, Major, KGB. He knew her face well, like he knew the face of the man at the other side of the cave. The high forehead and thinning hair, but no glasses. And he had been right. Paul Rubinstein wouldn't need them. Michael held Madison's body against him, his left arm around her slender shoulders, the knife in his left fist still.
We can't just leave here. We have to stop the people inside.
They were walking slowly, cannibals on each side of them now, closing behind them as he looked into Madison's eyes.
All right, son, if you feel we should, but just keep coming. Steady, even.
What are you gonna toss me?
My CAR-15. And remember, it's not an M16.
Right. 30-round stick?
30-round stick.
The cannibals closed tighter around them.
If it's a choice, Dad.
I know. Madison, I promise.
There will be no choice. We will all get out of here alive.
Michael was ready with the cattle prod, ready to thrust it into his first attacker to free his right hand for the CAR-15. He saw his father move, slowly, stabbing one of the pistols into his belt, all but his father's face, clearly visible now in the growing light inside the cave. He saw a silhouette, a scoped assault rifle, the stock of a different shape from that of an M16, the barrel seeming shorter.
What happened to your guns?
Inside. They have an arsenal in there and they don't do anything but clean it. Don't even know how to use guns.
The cannibals were tightening around them.
Michael, you and Madison stop there. I'm coming to you.
John!
His father didn't answer Natalia. He began to walk, the CAR-15 in his right hand, almost casually it seemed, his arm hanging down at his right side, in his left hand one of the Detonix pistols. Michael stopped, holding Madison tighter against him, some of the cannibals starting to reach out to touch at them.
When I get to you, you and I will go back to back with Madison between us. You got it?
Right.
Michael could see his father's face in greater resolution now, the dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses.
Can she use weapons, son?
I will try.
Good girl.
His father nodded, the right corner of his mouth raising in what looked like a half smile. John Rourke stopped walking, less than a yard separating them. Slowly, he reached out his right arm, extending it to nearly full length, the CAR-15 inches from Michael's chest.
Give Madison that cattle prod and don't drop it. Make your play when I do. Natalia and Paul will back us up.
Michael pushed the cattle prod into Madison's right hand, which was trembling. He raised his right hand to the rifle, closing his fist onto the pistol grip, inserting his trigger finger through the guard, his thumb finding the selector, verifying that it was set to fire. He lowered the rifle to his right side and watched his father. John Rourke reached slowly into a side pocket of his Levi's, his left hand reappearing, the Zippo lighter in it. The flame was blue-yellow and steady. The cannibal shrank back.
You didn't tell me you were a specialist in mob psychology.
Ah, you live 500 years, you pick up things, son.
Rourke raised the lighter up so all eyes would follow it, misdirecting the attention of the cannibals. He slowly moved his right hand in the direction of the Detonix pistol at his belt. The hand with the lighter moved to the side pocket, the thumb hooking in the pocket for an instant, then the lighter disappearing.
Count to three.
One, two.
Rourke's right hand gripped the Detonix pistol.
Three!
Natalia aimed her M16 high over the heads of the Rourkes and Madison into the cannibals behind them. Father and son stood back to back, the girl between them, the CAR-15 in Michael's hands. In John's clenched fists were both of his Detonix stainless pistols. Near Natalia, Paul Rubinstein was firing his MP40. Rourke's 45s were empty. He reached for the Python. Natalia's M16 was empty. As it fell to her side on its sling, both her hands found the butts of the Metal Life Custom L frames. A cannibal lunged for her as she lifted her revolvers. Her revolvers were empty, and there was no more gunfire except for Paul's Browning High Power. The volley song from Natalia's hip pocket came into her hand. The Weehawk blade sliced cannibal flesh, the artery spraying blood as the body fell. Natalia could see both Michael and John Rourke now, with Madison still between them, each of the Rourke men wielding one of the stone axes. One of the cannibals came for Michael. Michael pulled the axe from the cannibal's skull as his father hacked and chopped at their common enemies. The snarls were perhaps curses in the grunted language of the cannibals. Death surrounded Natalia as she slashed and hacked with the bodysaw. On the far side of the cave, the cracks of Paul Rubinstein's pistol had stopped. He would be using his blade now, too. She could see the Rourke man ahead. She fought toward them. Rourke wheeled. Three men with axes were closing in on his son. Rourke shoved the girl aside, hacking outward with the stone axe. He stepped between Michael and three cannibals. Michael's own axe was swinging outward against the face of the farthest cannibal. Rourke's axe impacted the head of the second. The axe of the third cannibal was on a downswing. Rourke sidestepped. His son was a blur of motion. Rourke wheeled toward Madison. She was hacking outward with the cattle prod. Smoke rose from the cannibal's face. The thought crossed John Rourke's mind that Madison would make a good Rourke. Michael's axe chopped downward against the head of the man Madison had struck with the cattle prod. Rourke brought his axe through in a wide arc, and five of the cannibals took a step back. Then something impacted Rourke's left shoulder. He stumbled, the axe falling from his hands, his left arm numbed for an instant. His right hand found the butt of the Gerber MK2 in the belt sheath and drew the blade. He wheeled quickly as the blood sprayed, checking the positions of Michael and the rest. Natalia was beside him, with her bodysong flashing in the sunlight that now filled the cave, red blood dripping from the blade. Paul was wrenching his fighting knife free of a body, and it had stopped. Rourke's right hand held the Gerber, poised, ready. But the cannibals who still stood were withdrawing, backing out of the cave, or running in fear. A fresh magazine went up the well of Rubinstein Schmeisser.
Leave him, Paul! Let him withdraw!
All right. But in case they come back, we'll be ready again.
Rourke only nodded, relieved that the people he cared about had survived the ordeal. There was a moment for renewing old acquaintances and forming new ones.
Mr. Rubinstein, or is it Uncle Paul?
Paul's fine. Chronologically, you're older than I am now.
Major Tiamarovna, good to see you after all these years.
Michael, you are your father's mirror image.
So I hear. You're lovely. I see why my father feels the way he does about you. He told me all about it once before he took the sleep so that I'd care for you if something went wrong and he didn't wake up. But you did. He loves you.
Phew. You got a big mouth.
I'm your son. Dad, this is Madison. She doesn't have any other name, but she will. I'm going to marry her. Or whatever it is you do when the people outside are cannibals and the people inside are religious fanatics who use genocide for population control.
Madison. Daughter. So Madison Rourke. Sounds good.
He glanced at Natalia. She was wiping her blade clean on a bandana handkerchief.
Here, use this for your knife.
She passed it to him.
Paul and I can take care of getting the bikes down here. Paul can ride them down one at a time and I can cover him.
That takes too much time. Cover him for the first bike, then each of you ride the last two down while I cover you.
You found my bike?
Rourke smiled at his son.
Yep, we found your bike.
That the cannibals would return was not something Rourke thought debatable. It was obvious. Michael and Madison had shown Natalia the location of one of the door panels in the rock wall of the cave, and Natalia, Paul helping her, was already at work to open it.
All that KGB training. I was always very good at breaking into things.
John Rourke stood at the mouth of the cave, his son beside him, Madison with Paul and Natalia.
I guess I fucked things up.
Rourke looked at his son.
Yeah, well, welcome to the club.
What do you mean?
Your mother. She's angry, more angry than I've ever seen her, because of what I did, using the cryogenic chambers to let you and your sister reach maturity while the rest of us slept.
It was the only practical thing.
And don't let your mother hear you say that.
She'll get over it.
I don't think so. Maybe it's good in a way. Like you said, that maybe you've gotten Madison pregnant. I mean, a grandchild for her. But at her age...
John Rourke felt himself smile. There was no sign of the enemy, but they had already proven they were good at using natural cover. They could be ready to attack again, he realized.
Nah, maybe a grandchild will help her feel better about herself. But it won't make her feel better about me.
You mean...
I don't know what I mean.
Rourke looked at his son. It was like staring into a mirror. Michael stood well above 6 feet, a full shock of dark brown hair, brown eyes, the prominent jaw. But there were fewer lines in his face, and unlike John Rourke, not yet a trace of gray.
I thought we might have lost you, but I'm embarrassed. I should have known you could take care of yourself.
It was touch and go there for a while. I'm glad you all showed up when you did. I was going to kill Madison if I had to.
I know that.
You would have done the same, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would have. And I wouldn't have liked it any better. This thing with your mother and me,
I figured we could go exploring together, see what's out there, you know?
You're gonna have a family.
That never stopped you.
Rourke looked away and smiled.
No, it never stopped me, you're right. Maybe it should have, though, son. Maybe it should have.
If Madison is carrying a child, well, there'll still be time before the child comes and after.
You mean leave the girls at home? You and me and Paul?
Well, sure. Paul, too. He's your partner.
Yeah, he's the best friend I ever had. You are, too, but you're my son. So that allows me to have two best friends. Whatever happens, well, don't get into this thing between your mother and me. It wouldn't be right for her to think I'd turn you or Annie against her. I'd never want that.
Doesn't she realize why you did it? I mean, I know. You set things up so Natalia and I would,
Am I that transparent?
Yes, you are. Yes.
Yeah, I guess I am. But it didn't work, did it?
You were willing to give up Natalia for your love for Mom.
You mean I was willing to give up one woman I love for the other woman I love? It doesn't say a whole hell of a lot for me, does it?
But all that time you searched for us, and you never...
No, I wanted to. God, did I want to. But as long as there was a chance your mother was alive, your mother and I, we fell in love with each other, and we're still in love. But we were never, well, we were never really friends. You know, I knew this couple once. The guy was a writer. He and his wife, you never saw two people so much in love. But they were buddies, pals, friends. The friendship and the love coexisted.
What about you and Natalia?
We're friends. It's your mother's play. I'll do what she wants.
What about Natalia if I...
What?
Rourke smiled.
I don't know. I woke up from a little more than just a second cryogenic sleep, you know? Your mother was heartsick about the loss of her small children. That's when I really woke up, and I decided I'd never try playing God again. I mean, I didn't try this last time. I just tried to do what was right, what was best for all of us. I did what I thought was... shit.
He turned away from Michael and faced into the wind. He felt his son's hand on his shoulder. Annie Rourke hitched up her skirt as she clambered over the rocks, getting to her feet again, letting her skirt fall, straightening the webbed pistol belt at her right hip, the Detonic Scoremaster there in the military flap holster. She could see for miles from here. She had started coming up here as a little girl. She didn't remember their home at the farm. Perhaps someday they would go back to where it had stood, and something she would see would jog loose a memory. She hoped that it would. But the retreat was the home she had grown up in, was the home in her heart. She dropped to her knees, gathering her skirt under her, leaning back, sitting finally, not taking her eyes off the mountains and the valleys between them. She was cold as the wind picked up, and she hugged her arms to her, huddling more in the quilted coat she had made. She had never known the company of adults of her own sex, and she wondered if she and Paul did find themselves drawn together, would they sometime, someday, be wrenched apart? She thought of her mother. The retreat was not Sarah Rourke's home. It never would be. She hated it. That was obvious, Annie realized. She thought of her father and her mother, and she was frightened. She had known nothing else, that Sarah and John Rourke were husband and wife, and that it was forever for them. She was very cold now. She closed her eyes and saw Paul Rubinstein's face, and tried to imagine feeling toward Paul what her mother now felt toward her father. For an instant, she could imagine it, and she was afraid. She sat there and stared out at the mountains again, wanting Paul Rubinstein to say he loved her, to hold her. The interior airlock had not taken as long as the exterior door, which had been covered with rock.
I have it, John.
Rourke watched her for a moment, then stared at the dismantled blocking device.
They never intended their retreat to be unoccupied.
It was never made to be opened from the outside.
Rourke nodded to her. He looked at his son, Madison, standing beside him.
You said the second holy book is some sort of diary?
It looks like that. One of the videotapes had a diary featured in the story, and I read about diaries.
All right, so we get this second holy book and break the seal and read it.
That is forbidden, even to ones like yourselves.
John Rourke put his hands on the girl's shoulders, then smiled at her.
Michael tells me the Bible is very important to the people here, at least to some of you.
That is true. It is all that we read.
Then isn't it presumptuous for men like the ones who head the families to add to it, to change it with some secret book they won't even read themselves, but that supposedly gives them the authority to commit murder every time the population goes over some magic number, year in, year out, to create people like the ones you call them, to create people who aren't people anymore at all?
But...
I look at the story of Adam and Eve rather differently than most people do. If their aim was to seek knowledge, I don't see it as a sin. To play games with the devil, that's wrong. But to want to know, to understand, knowing isn't evil. It's what you do with the knowledge. We'll find that book. You think Natalia's good on doors? Wait till you see her with the safe. We'll read that book, and then we'll know what really happened here and how to help all the Madisons and all the other people here. Or at least we'll be better able to try. All right, sweetheart?
Yes.
She leaned her head against his chest.
Yes, Father Rourke.
John Rourke just closed his eyes and hugged the girl for a moment.
We're ready.
All right.
I'll go first.
He was already starting to open the doorway, Michael covering him with Rourke's CAR-15. Then Michael passed through.
There's no one waiting for us.
There may be a redoubt of some kind further ahead.
Madison passed through the doorway then. Rourke stood alone beside Natalia. She touched at his hand.
If I were a young girl, you would make a fine father.
Just because I let myself age another 5 years while you slept? Hey, don't rub it in, huh?
And he let Natalia pass through the doorway, and he followed her close behind, a Detonix pistol in each hand. They stepped out onto the perfect green carpet.
The last thing I ever expected to see again in my whole life was a golf course.
Rourke shrugged. After the Olympic-sized indoor pool and the sauna and the racquetball courts, an indoor 9-hole golf course hardly surprised him. That it was only 9 holes, he found curious. He dropped to one knee. What he felt through the knee of his Levi's, the touch of his fingertips confirmed. Synthetic grass. It had been called AstroTurf before the night of the war.
I have never seen this place.
Rourke looked at Madison.
This place. The place. It's hermetically sealed at most times. At all times, really, because of the airlock. No dust, no dirt. No reason for maintenance. The pool is bone dry, likely hasn't been filled for centuries. I bounced one of those racket balls. The core is dead, hasn't been used for a long time.
A playground?
The rich capitalist playground.
Yes, isn't it?
He reached up to the Alessi shoulder rig, returning the one Detonix pistol he still held.
Let's find that arsenal, then we'll find their book. If they can't use what they have, maybe we can. With that door having to be forced open, the hermetic seal is broken. If those cannibals have an ounce of brains among them, they'll feel the air circulating between the crack in the door and the wall, and they'll pry it open and attack. What Michael told us about that one cannibal following him and Madison on a blood hunt, that may be typical behavior, and we killed a lot of them. Now, everyone be on the lookout for those guys in the business suits with the cattle prods. Madison, show us the way to the arsenal.
Where the guns are.
Yes, where the guns are kept.
She started ahead, walking beside and slightly ahead of Michael, her right hand locked inside his left. Michael's right fist balled around the CAR-15's pistol grip. The Colt assault rifle's stock collapsed, the scope covers removed. Rourke felt a hand touch at his gently. He looked into Natalia's eyes, his left hand closing over her right hand.
He looks so much like you, but he isn't you.
And she leaned up quickly as she walked beside him, kissing him on the cheek.
I love you.
Still holding her hand, they walked on. Natalia opened the doors to the arsenal, not bothering to pick the lock. The doors opened inward. Paul rushed in, the subgun ready in case the families had decided the arsenal should be their redoubt. But the arsenal was empty of people.
Who were these people?
Hell of an arsenal, huh?
Rourke looked at him for an instant, then to the walls. What he estimated is 100 M16s were in racks locked to the wall with retention bars, the bars padlocked. Beyond these, smaller racks, three tiers high, at least 50 government model 45s in each of the racks, perhaps 150 in all. Beyond these, a solitary glass-fronted rack. Rourke walked toward this and examined what lay beyond the glass. Six Steyr Mannlicher SSGs, identical to his own rifle, which was back at the retreat.
My guns!
Rourke turned around, seeing his son examining the long glass case on the opposite wall. Rourke looked back to the rifle case, his right hand feeling behind it where the case should have met the wall. There was a gap, uneven.
Oh!
Then he started across the room. The carpeted center of the room, which he considered curious, was piled high with wooden and cardboard crates and metal military carry boxes. Ammunition. 5.56mm for the M16s, 45 ACP for the pistols, and 7.62mm NATO for the sniper rifles. But there were other boxes as well. Commercial ammunition in 9mm Parabellum, 44 Magnum, and 357 Magnum, as well as boxes of shot shells, all seemingly 12-gauge, the majority double-aught buck. Some rifled slugs as well, he noted. He continued across the room. Natalia stood beside Michael, her attention seeming to shift nervously from the long gun cabinet to the double doors leading back into the corridor. Rourke looked at the gun cabinet. Handguns. An expensive collection. Some neatly arranged on fabric-covered pegs, some just lying in the bottom of the cabinet.
Our friends had interesting tastes.
Rourke was looking at the Smith & Wesson and Colt revolvers, Walther and Browning semi-automatics. Along the bottom of the case, mixed in with the handguns, several shotguns, Remington 870s and 1100s, Mossberg 500s of various configurations, Browning Auto 5s.
This room would have been worth a fortune.
Nah, not this room. At least not originally. This room wasn't the arsenal to begin with. It was some other room. That case holding the sniper rifles, it was removed from its original mountings. And this one...
Rourke bent to the side, feeling along the wall.
This is the same. With the airlocks and all, they were security conscious. You don't leave an arsenal like this in a room a woman can kick her way into without half trying.
Thank you. Not at all.
Even a very special woman. No. There's a vault around here. And if it were important enough to remove this stuff from the vault, then whatever they put in the vault must have been even more important. Stand back.
And Rourke waited as Natalia, Michael, Madison, and Paul Rubinstein stepped away from the glass. Rourke stepped back, selecting the spot. He kicked into the glass.
What do you do?
With those guys outside, we'll need more equipment than we have. This is called liberating.
John explained it to me once, a long time ago, Madison. Before the night of the war, taking something just because you needed it was stealing. But since then, taking something you need to stay alive is survival. So it's liberating.
It's still stealing, but it's in a good cause.
Michael already was reaching through the opening broken into the glass for his stalker, his predator. Michael checked both guns.
Empty.
At least they know how to do that.
Michael slipped the Predator into the trouser band of his Levi's.
Wonder where the hell they put the rest of my stuff.
We'll find it. Liberate some ammo for yourself, huh?
Michael reached into the case again, having handed off the Predator to Madison, who seemed frightened of holding a gun. Rourke already knew his son well enough. He would teach her to get over this fear quickly enough. Guns themselves were nothing to fear, only some of the people who used them. Guns could just as easily be an instrument to eradicate fear. He watched his son take three Smith & Wesson Model 629s, 8 3/8, a 6, and a 4.
Don't you think you're overdoing it a little?
I like 44s, but you were right. I needed to add something that loads a little faster. These'll do for now.
Rourke only shook his head.
Look in that bin at the far end of the room. See what they have, maybe holsters or whatever.
All three of the stainless Smiths were wearing the factory walnut, and they wouldn't reload that much faster without speed loaders. Natalia was taking a Walther P-38 from the cabinet.
One extra pistol will do me nicely. I've used these before. But I'm going to pick the locks on those chains and get us some extra M16s.
She turned to Madison.
Would you like to help me, darling?
All right.
Madison followed after her. Rourke watched as Paul took two blued commercial Browning high powers. These, like the battered military model Rubinstein carried, old enough to have the cone hammers rather than the spur-type hammers, similar to those on the Colt government model. They would return what they had taken if the situation warranted it. As much as he joked about it, liberating was still a form of stealing, even when necessary. But John Rourke knew what he would borrow, at least. He had given his to Annie, and there were two here. Detonix Scoremaster 45s, the cone-hammered flat mainspring housing stainless steel Detonix counterpart to the Colt Gold Cup. He took the two pistols into his hands. They were factory original, except that the once sharp corners of the high-profile Bomar rear sights had been rounded off. As he closed his fists over the Packmire-gripped butts, the beaver tail grip safeties deactivated. There was a good feel to the guns. He would regret having to return them, but he would. Michael started toward the bins to find spare magazines, if there were any. He found more than what he was looking for.
Packmire grips? Safariland speed loaders? Boxes of spare magazines for all the magazine-fed weapons?
Good. Take what you think we'll need and get Packmire's onto those Smith revolvers. Detaya's got a screwdriver. Oh, and take plenty of those speed loaders.
These people had good taste.
Take a couple of extra pistols for yourself, Paul, and a couple of M16s. If we can avoid getting down to stone axes again, I'd just as soon.
You just as soon.